imposes neo-colonial control on Gaza. That's if they can implement it. Now, a key element of Trump's UN-endorsed plan is the creation of an international stabilization force authorized, quote, to use all necessary measures to carry out its mandate, which includes disarming Palestinian resistance organizations. It also calls for the establishment of a so-called Board of Peace headed by Trump himself to govern and rebuild Gaza. Now, we've been reporting from the beginning that disarming the resistance against its will is an impossible task that no country is willing or able to do, especially after Israel, with full Western backing, spent more than 2 years perpetrating genocide and utterly failing to defeat the Palestinian resistance. But according to recent reports, not only are the U.S. efforts to put together an international stabilization force stalled, they're actually moving in reverse. And I want to take a closer look at some of those reports now, starting from this big article that appeared in the Washington Post on November 29th with the headline, "International Force at Heart of Trump's Gaza Plan Struggles to Find Takers." And I'm just going to kind of read through some key points and comment on them. That's how I'm going to do this. It says the proposed deployment of an international force in Gaza, seen as a crucial feature of President Donald Trump's plan to bring peace to the enclave, is struggling to get off the ground as countries considered likely to contribute soldiers have grown wary. Concerns are mounting in foreign capitals over whether soldiers could be put in a position where they may be required to use force against Palestinians. That's a point we've made all along, that no one wants to sign up to fight the Qassam brigades. And according to the Washington Post, Indonesia, which had announced it would send as many as 20,000 peacekeeping troops, is now looking at providing a much smaller contingent. Azerbaijan, which had also been expected to send troops, has also reassessed, according to officials speaking to the Washington Post, and not one Arab country has committed to sending soldiers. A month ago, things were in a better place, said one regional official with knowledge of the discussions, the Washington Post reports. And then they say that even countries that are keen to win favor with the U.S. administration, many uncertainties remain for them, including the thorny question of how the force would go about securing weapons from Hamas, which has sent mixed signals about its willingness to disarm. I don't think they've been mixed at all. They've been quite clear they won't be disarming in any context other than there being a real sovereign Palestinian state to which they can hand over their weapons. Quote, they want the international stabilizing force to come into Gaza and restore law and order and disarm any resistance, a senior official in Indonesia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said, as quoted in the Washington Post. So that's the problem. Nobody wants to do that, the official added. And then they detail that Indonesia, instead of this 20,000 that they talked about, is now talking about maybe sending 1,200 soldiers to do various tasks that definitely don't include fighting against the resistance. And according to the Washington Post, it says here, Middle East governments had rebuked Indonesia for going out ahead of them and committing peacekeepers, according to an official the Washington Post quotes. And now the Indonesians are saying they're going to focus on health and construction rather than anything to do with the force that is disarming the resistance. Notable here, too, according to the Washington Post, is that Gulf countries that had been expected to participate have cold feet, according to a regional official quoted by the Post. Anwar Gargash, a diplomatic advisor to the president of the United Arab Emirates, said earlier this month that his government does not see a clear framework for the force, according to the Washington Post. And that's really significant because the United Arab Emirates is one of the closest allies of Israel and the United States in the region. Quote, The ambiguity of this whole thing is not settling very well here in Abu Dhabi, said Abdul Khaliq Abdullah, a prominent Emirati political scientist who described a 180-degree turn in the Emirates' willingness to send troops over the last year. And the same vagueness and uncertainty also applies to the so-called Board of Peace, which is supposed to be the civilian governance arm of this Trump peace plan. And the Washington Post says, the establishment of an international force is part of the second phase of Trump's plan, which also calls for a Board of Peace, headed by Trump, to oversee Gaza for 2 years. Then they quote another regional official, unnamed official, quote, we thought with the Security Council resolution, within 48 to 72 hours, the Board of Peace would be announced, but nothing, not even informally, has happened. So that gives a sense of the disarray there. And then finally, there is this little bit where Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has expressed skepticism over the feasibility of an international force. The Washington Post says, quote, we said, go ahead, try, Netanyahu said of discussions with Washington during an interview last week with the Israeli social media outlet Abu Ali Express. Quote, they think international forces from different countries might disarm Hamas. Fine, you can try. End quote. Well, that's Netanyahu's view, which is apparently similar to our analysis that the Israeli army can't do it. Certainly Indonesia and Azerbaijan can't either. But this is the really sinister part of what Netanyahu is saying, according to the Washington Post. Israel is working on the assumption that it will eventually have to demilitarize Hamas itself because no one else will be willing, said Ofer Gutterman, a senior researcher at the Institute for National Security Studies. So that's the conclusion, really, of the Washington Post story, and really provides us with some insight into why Israel is absolutely unwilling to declare an end to the war or to stop its genocide, because they want to go back to a full-throated genocide. Of course, the question, and this is where John's analysis is so helpful, is whether Israel is capable, and we still see no sign that they are. Now, let's move to another article from the Washington Post, and this is a column yesterday from David Ignatius. He's a regular columnist, but he's a very reliable mouthpiece for deep state intelligence services and officials. So you read him in order to understand what the government and intelligence services think. And he provides additional context around the disarray in Gaza in his column headlined, "The Middle East's Moment of Opportunity is Slipping Away." And he begins by saying that the past 2 years of war brought death and destruction to the Middle East, but they also created remarkable openings for change in Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. So you can see the perspective of where he's coming from. However, he says, sadly, those opportunities might be squandered because of mishandling and delay by the United States, Israel, and the Arab states. Everything is stuck, a senior Israeli defense official told me this week, this is David Ignatius writing, because diplomats have failed to capitalize on the disarray of Iran and its allies. All the fronts in the Middle East are still open, he warned. Then Ignatius points out, he says, other than the release of all living Israeli hostages from Gaza, most of the goals of Trump's 20-point peace plans appear stillborn. Israel achieved some stunning successes in its bloody campaigns against Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. But Robert Satloff, director of the Washington Institute, now that's a think tank set up by the Israel lobby group AIPAC, I'm telling you that. David Ignatius doesn't disclose it at all. Robert Satloff cautioned in an interview this week that, quote, the Israelis have so far failed to translate battlefield victories into political achievements. These are sad and regrettable lost opportunities. Now, I point that up because that admission is important, that Israel's most fanatical supporters and representatives in Washington, as AIPAC and its think tanks are, don't see Israel as having won victories or succeeding. And that gives us a sense that all of the Israeli announcements of great victories and stunning successes, whether against Hamas, Hezbollah, or Iran, are hot air. What they really think is that they have failed. What Sattloff is suggesting there, and this reflects the thinking of many officials and David Ignatius, as we'll see in a moment, is that it could have gone another way if they had been clever enough in, you know, finding the right collaborators or training just the right number of Palestinian police, that, you know, they could have taken that opportunity. What they don't seem to understand is that Israel's methods of massacres and destruction and genocide and assassinations of leaders don't work. They don't address Israel's fundamental issue, which is its illegitimacy in the eyes of the people of the region and their unwillingness to submit to living under its brutality and their unwillingness to give up their rights in favor of Zionism. And Ignatius admits that Israel's war in Gaza or its genocide in Gaza illustrates, quote, the limits of Israeli military power to achieve political results. He concedes that Hamas still controls half of Gaza, where roughly 85% of the population live, and that the other elements, the Board of Peace and the Stabilization Force, are still, in his words, just a fantasy. Now, I'm going to end looking at his article with this paragraph. I'll read it and then I'll comment on it. How can Trump and his partners break this logjam? They can recognize the screamingly obvious fact that the only force that can effectively disarm Hamas will be Palestinians allied with a reformed version of the Palestinian Authority. Many Israeli military and security officials have long embraced this view. So what Ignatius is saying here is that what we need is a Palestinian civil war, that we need Palestinians allied with the reformed Palestinian Authority to disarm Hamas, and that this is the vision of many Israeli military and security officials, which he's trying to launder in the pages of the Washington Post as common sense. But of course, we've seen how when Israel tries that, time and time again, it fails. And of course, the United States sponsored the original civil war between Hamas and Fatah back in 2006 after Hamas won those Palestinian legislative elections. And what's also interesting in Ignatius's stenography of official thinking is that there is no mention whatsoever of Palestinian rights. And in his column, there isn't even a cursory mention of a Palestinian state. That is where official thinking is, that the question of Palestine is merely one of finding the right caliber bullets to kill the right Palestinians and to find the right collaborators to rule the survivors on behalf of the colonial occupier. These people just are incapable of conceiving that the Palestinians are a people with rights, dignity, and determination to win their liberation. And that's why these schemes, no matter how much death and destruction they cause, will fail time and time again. And that brings me to the next article. You may have been wondering all this time, where are the sensible, reasonable Europeans? Well, here they are. They're working with Egypt to try to set up a force of Palestinian collaborators to go into Gaza. And we have, from just the past couple of days, this really lengthy report from the Times of Israel with the headline, Egypt and EU stepping up preparations to dispatch Palestinian police force to Gaza. And as is often the case, that headline is somewhat misleading, because if you were only going to read the headline, you'd think they were just about ready to send these forces in. When you read the article, you find that they are also in just as much disarray as the so-called International Stabilization Force. And let's take a look at just some of the key passages of this article and what they reveal about the political intent of those behind this scheme. The article starts off saying Egypt and the European Union are preparing to expand training of Palestinian police for deployment in Gaza under US President Donald Trump's 20-point peace plan for the Strip. Two diplomats and a foreign official briefed on the issue have told the Times of Israel. The force, like many components of the U.S. framework, remains largely aspirational, said the officials, who include an Arab and a European diplomat. So David Ignatius called Trump's plan a fantasy, and here the Times of Israel is calling it largely aspirational. And they detail how really nothing about it has been finalized. But the goal, it's a rehashing of the same old plans that they've tried time and again, which is just what David Ignatius proposed, to pit Palestinians against each other, to try to recruit Palestinians to do what the Israeli army couldn't do, and here in the guise of a police force. And the Times of Israel says, before the war, Gaza was policed by an estimated 5,000 to 10,000 officers serving under the auspices of Hamas, which has controlled the Gaza Strip since 2007, but is supposed to cede power under the Trump plan. Now, of course, Hamas didn't agree to any of the other points in the Trump plan, except the first phase, which had to do with the ceasefire and the exchange of prisoners and the entry of humanitarian aid provisions, all of which Israel is still violating. And when I say Hamas, I mean Hamas and all the other resistance factions together in a united front. The Times of Israel says, in its place, in place of Hamas, that is, the international community is seeking to install an armed Palestinian force tasked with day-to-day law enforcement. And then they talk about, I won't go into all the detail about the arrangements Egypt and the EU are doing and the training they're trying to do, with Jordan involved as well. And they say that one of the key things they want to do is bring in former officers of the Palestinian Authority security forces who are loyal to the Palestinian Authority, Ramallah and Mahmoud Abbas, who continued to receive Palestinian Authority salaries after 2007, even though they were just sitting at home. And that's where they're hoping to find thousands of people to join the police. They say, according to the Times of Israel, since 2007, some 7,000 police officers are believed to have remained in Gaza on the PA payroll. Michael Milstein, a senior researcher at Tel Aviv University's Dayan Center, said few officers likely remain fit for reintegration after nearly two decades away from the police work. So now they're suggesting, and this is where it gets somewhat comical, that those guys who have been sitting at home for 20 years getting salaries, who are incapable of going out, you know, and carrying guns and being in the street, can sit at desks and do bureaucratic work, and they'll find other people to go out into the streets, but it's not clear where. But what is clear in the article, they say here, the European diplomat said most of the 3,000 officers the EU hopes to train would come from Gaza and be trained in Egypt, though the exact site is not finalized. And here's really the crucial line that tells you what this force is about. The Times of Israel says, vetting would be handled by Israel and the U.S. So you can put Egypt's name on it. You can put the, do-gooder Europeans. They're going to be the ones paying for it. But vetting would be handled by Israel and the U.S. So this force would be hand-picked by the United States, Israel, to serve as traitors and collaborators against the Palestinian people in the service of schemes backed by Arab regimes to destroy the Palestinian people and their cause. That is, when you distill all this babble down, that's always what you get to. And I'll just end my look at the Times of Israel article with this. On paper, they always say, well, this is about providing policing and security to ordinary Gazans. But they're very open about the political goals here. And the Times of Israel says both Egypt and the EU see the police as a key entry point for reaching Gazans on the ground and shaping the Strip's post-war recovery. In other words, they say, quote, the police force could also enable a gradual, non-violent transition of power by providing a viable non-Hamas security presence. A third foreign official said members of the force could form the next leadership of Gaza, including future intelligence heads. So this is about installing a collaborator leadership, not one elected by Palestinians. Finally, and this takes me into some of the news that came out today, towards the end of the Times of Israel article, they talk about whether these, we've covered them before, these ISIS-linked, Israeli-backed gangs of criminals and collaborators, Palestinian criminals and collaborators backed by Israel, that Israel has been using and supporting to terrorize people in Gaza, to steal aid and setting them up as kind of a proxy force to maintain chaos in Gaza, whether they would be integrated into the police force. And the Times of Israel says, local armed militias opposed to Hamas also operate, some having cooperated with Israel during the war, and some still protecting civilians in IDF-held areas. At least one report suggested such militias might be integrated into the police force. And this reminds me of how, to broaden the scope, we've seen the Europeans and the Americans integrating literal neo-Nazis, Sieg Heiling, swastika-tattooed Nazis into the official armed forces of Ukraine on the one hand, and we see how they're supporting a so-called government closely tied with ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria, and they would like to do the same here, to place ISIS-linked gangs into the official police force that they hope to send into Gaza. The Times of Israel says militia leader Hussam al-Astal said he received messages from American representatives indicating that his group and others could play a role in Gaza's future police force. Now, the Israeli analyst Milstein is actually the one to pour cold water on this. He says, according to the Times of Israel, that such groups are small and widely viewed as criminals, narcotics runners, or collaborators. He argued integrating them would have obvious negative effects. That, of course, has never deterred the European, American, and Arab allies of Israel. But I think the biggest blow to any such scheme came with the news of the killing of Yasser Abu Shabab. He is, of course, the best known Palestinian collaborator in Israel, the head of an Israeli-backed, ISIS-linked criminal gang that Israel has unleashed on parts of Gaza over the last 2 years. Now, the circumstances of Abu Shabab's killing are murky. Israeli forces at first tried to portray it as sort of internecine violence or clan violence, while unconfirmed reports said that it was actually an operation carried out by the resistance. And this seems to be supported by a tweet from Shai Levy of Mako, which is an Israeli news outlet affiliated with Israel's Channel 12. And he says there, quote, Yasser Abu Shabab was eliminated because he aided Israel in the fighting, and especially in violations of Gaza's ceasefire agreement. Beyond that, nothing more can be written because censorship is being used in a draconian manner to conceal a strategic mishap that has already begun to follow up. Now, undoubtedly, more information will come out. The important point here is that Israel, the United States, the European Union, and perhaps some of the Arab tyrannies allied with them, were placing their hopes on anti-Palestinian collaborators like Abu Shabab to try to restore or to try to install in Gaza a regime to their liking and that would serve their and Israel's interests and not the Palestinian people. What the killing of Yasser Abu Shabab does is it really is a death blow to those fantasies. And it will certainly concentrate the minds of any of those few other Palestinians who would think about collaborating with Israel on such a scheme, even perhaps in the context of the so-called International Stabilization Force or the police, of the futility of doing so, that Israel is absolutely unwilling and unable to protect them.
That was the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima. In Gaza, a small team of animators are working with displaced children to make art through stop-motion film as one way to process trauma and tell their own stories. Hanin Kuraz, Shuruk Darwish, and Noor Ajawad of the Animators Workshop Project say that animation here is not just a skill, it is a new language of self-expression, a free space for profound artistic exploration. This short film called When She Left, Life Bloomed tells the story of an elderly man and woman walking together along a quiet road filled with the warmth of memories. Suddenly, a violent explosion shakes the ground, wounding the old woman. She becomes transparent and gradually begins to fade away. From her disappearing body, red roses emerge and drift with the wind until they land and take root and bring color and fragrance back to the barren land once again. The old man remains alone, watching both the loss and the life born from the womb of grief. In his eyes rests a deep sorrow, yet he witnesses love continuing in another form, a rose that never dies. This film was made by children between 9 and 12 years old from Al-Nusarat camp and Deir al-Balah. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is Bird Note. The Hawaiian Islands are home to many birds that don't exist anywhere else on Earth. Native forest songbirds like the kiwi-kiu, formerly called the Maui parrotbill, once thrived on the islands. Now, they are critically endangered. Kiwi-kiu co-evolved over millennia with the remarkable plants and insects in their unique island habitats. They're about the size of a sparrow, with yellowish olive-green feathers that blend into the foliage. The kiwi-kiu's parrot-like bill is perfectly adapted to chisel, crack, and tear apart bark in search of grubs. They sometimes enjoy flower nectar, too. Kiwi-kiu typically raise just one chick a year, and the parents will spend another year teaching their young how to forage with that distinctive bill. Like many of Maui's native birds, kiwi-kiu have been devastated by avian malaria and other fatal diseases spread by invasive mosquitoes. These days, the tiny remaining kiwi-kiu population is restricted to less than 11 square miles of high-elevation forests on the slopes of Haleakalā. Habitat protection and mosquito control are crucial for conserving Hawaii's extraordinary ecosystems, so birds like the kiwi-kiu can sing out from the forests for years to come. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.